nodded his head, even shouted out an amen. The words kept coming to Hank's heart and mind. It had to be the Lord's anointing. He stopped by the pulpit from time to time to look at his notes, but most of the time he was all over the platform, feeling like he was somewhere between heaven and earth, speaking forth the word of God. The few little demons lurking about could only cower and sneer. Some did manage to stop the ears of the people they owned, but the onslaught this morning was particularly severe and painful. To them, Hank's preaching had all the soothing effect of a buzzsaw. On top of the church, Cigna and his warriors refused to bend or back down. Lucius dropped by with a sizable flock of demons just in time for the service, but Cigna would not step aside.
"You know better than to tamper with me," Lucius threatened.
Cigna was sickeningly polite. "I'm sorry. We cannot allow any more demons into the church this morning." Lucius must have had more important things for his demons to do that morning than try to hack their way through a wall of obstinate angels. He delivered a few choice insults, and then the whole bunch roared off into the air, bound for some other mischief. When the service ended, some people made a beeline for the door. Others made a beeline for Hank.
"Pastor, my name is Andy Forsythe, and this is my wife, June."
"Hello, hello," Hank said, and he could feel a wide smile stretching his face.
"That was great,"
Andy said, shaking his head in amazement and still shaking Hank's hand.
"It was... boy, it was really great."
They made small talk for a few minutes, finding out about each other. Andy owned and ran the lumberyard just on the outskirts of town. June was a legal secretary. They had a son, Ron, who was in trouble with drugs and needed the Lord.
"Well," said Andy, "we haven't been saved too long ourselves. We used to go to the Ashton United Christian..."
His voice trailed off. June was less inhibited.
"We were starving there. We couldn't wait to get out."
Andy cut back in.
"Yeah, that's right. We heard about this church. Well, actually, we heard about you. We heard you were in a bit of trouble for being such a stickler with the Word of God, and we just thought to ourselves, we ought to check that guy out. Now I'm glad we did. Pastor," he continued, "I want you to know there are a lot of hungry people out there. We have some friends who love the Lord and have no place to go. It's been really strange the last few years. One by one, the churches around here have kind of died. Oh, they're still there, all right, and they have the people and the bucks, but, you know what I mean."
Hank wasn't sure that he did.
"What do you mean?"
Andy shook his head.
"Satan's really playing games with this town, I guess. Ashton never used to be this way with so much weird stuff going on. Hey, you may have trouble believing this, but we have friends who have dropped out of four of the local churches."
June exchanged glances with Andy as she went through a mental list of names.
"Greg and Eva Smith, the Bartons, the Jennings, Clint Neal."
"Yeah, right, right," said Andy. "Like I said, there are a lot of hungry people out there, sheep without a shepherd. The churches around here just don't cut it. They don't preach the gospel."
Just then, Mary walked up, all smiles. Hank happily introduced her. Then Mary said,
"Hank, I'd like you to meet..."
And she turned toward the empty room. Whoever was supposed to be there wasn't.
"Well, he's gone."
"Who was it?" Hank asked.
"Oh, you remember that big guy sitting in the back?"
"The big blonde guy?"
"Yes. I got a chance to talk to him. He told me to tell you that..."
Mary deepened her voice to mimic him.
"The Lord is with you. Keep praying and keep listening."
"Well, that was nice. Did you get his name?"
No, I don't think he ever told me."
Andy asked,
"Who was this?"
"Oh," said Hank, "you know, that big guy in the back. He was sitting right next to you."
Andy looked at June and her eyes got wide. Andy started smiling. Then he started laughing, and then he started clapping his hands and practically dancing.
"Praise the Lord!" he exclaimed.
And Hank hadn't seen such enthusiasm in a long time.
Praise the Lord, there was nobody there. Pastor, we didn't see a soul.
Mary's mouth dropped open, and she covered it with her fingers. Oliver Young was a real showman. He could work an audience right down to each tear or titter and time it so well that they became just so many puppets on a string. He would stand behind the pulpit with incredible dignity and poise, and his words were so well chosen that whatever he was saying had to be right. The vast congregation certainly seemed to think so. They had packed the place out. Many of them were professionals, doctors, teachers, lawyers, self-proclaimed philosophers and poets. A very large segment was from or connected in some way with the college. They took fastidious notes on Young's message as if it were a lecture. Marshall had heard a lot of this little song and dance before, so on this particular Sunday he mulled over the questions he couldn't wait to spring on Young after the service was over. Young continued, "Did not God say, 'Let us make man in our image according to our likeness?' What had remained in the darkness of tradition and ignorance, we find now revealed within ourselves. We discover, no, rather we rediscover the knowledge we have always had as a race. We are inherently divine in our very essence, and have within ourselves the capacity for good, the potential to become, as it were, gods, made in the exact likeness of Father God, the ultimate source of all that is." Marshall took a quick and furtive glance sideways. There was Kate, and there was Sandy, taking notes like mad, and next to her sat Sean Ormsby. Sandy and Sean had hit it off pretty well, and he had a definite positive influence on her life. Today, for example, he had made a deal with Sandy. He would go to church with her if she would go with her folks. Well, it worked. Marshall had to admit, even though a little reluctantly, that Sean could communicate with Sandy in ways Marshall never could. There had been several occasions when Sean had served quite well as a liaison or interpreter between Sandy and Marshall, and opened lines of communication neither of them thought could ever materialize. Things were getting peaceful around the house at last. Sean seemed a gentle sort with a real gift for refereeing. "So, what do I do now?" Marshall wondered. "For the first time in who knows how long, my whole family is sitting together in church, and that's nothing but a miracle, a real miracle. But we sure picked one heck of a church to be sitting together in. And as for that preacher up there, it would be so comfortable and so nice to let everything be. But he was a reporter, and this Young had something to hide. Nuts! Talk about conflict of interests." So while Pastor Oliver Young was up there trying to get across his ideas on the infinite divine potential within seemingly finite man, Marshall had his own nagging issues to think about. The service ended punctually at noon, and the carillon in the tower automatically clicked on and began to play a very traditional, very Christian-sounding accompaniment to all the handshaking, visiting, and filing out. Marshall and his family entered the flow of traffic that oozed toward the foyer. Oliver Young was standing by the front door in his usual spot, greeting all his parishioners, shaking hands, coochie-cooing the babies, being pastorly. Soon Marshall, Kate, Sandy, and Sean had their turn with him. "Well, Marshall, good to see you," Young gushed, shaking Marshall's hand. "Have you met Sandy?" Marshall asked and formally introduced Young to his daughter. Young was very warm. "Sandy, I'm very glad to see you." Sandy, at least, acted glad to be there. "And Sean," Young exclaimed. "Sean Ormsby." The two of them shook hands. "Oh, so you two know each other?" Marshall asked. "Oh, I've known Sean since he was just a little shaver. Sean, don't make yourself so scarce, all right?" "All right," Sean answered with a shy smile. The others moved on, but Marshall lagged behind and came up close on the other side to speak to Young some more. He waited until Young had finished greeting one little group of people and then interjected into the pause. "Hey, I just thought you'd like to know that things are going better now with Sandy and me."
Young smiled, shook a few hands, then said sideways to Marshall,
"Wonderful! That's really wonderful, Marshall."
He offered his hand to someone else.
"Nice seeing you here today."
In another space between exiting greetees, Marshall interjected,
"Yeah, she really enjoyed your sermon this morning. She said it was very challenging." "Well, thank you for saying so. Yes, Mr. Beaumont, how are you?" "You know, it even seemed to be along the same lines as what Sandy's getting in school in Julian Langstrat's classes."
Young didn't answer that, but directed all his attention to a young couple with a baby.
"Oh, my, she's getting so big."
Marshall continued,
"You're going to have to meet Professor Langstrat sometime. There's a very interesting parallel between what she teaches and what you preach."
There was no response from Young.
"I understand, as a matter of fact, that Langstrat's pretty deeply involved in occultism and Eastern mysticism."
"Well," Young finally responded, "I wouldn't know anything about that, Marshall."
"And you definitely don't know this Professor Langstrat?"
"No, I told you that."
"Haven't you attended several private sessions with her on a regular basis? And not only you, but also Alf Brummell, Ted Harmel, Dolores Pinkston, Eugene Baylor, and even Judge Baker?"
Young turned just a little red, paused, then grimaced with embarrassed recollection.
"Oh, for goodness sake," he laughed. "Where in the world has my mind been? You know, all this time I've been thinking of someone else."
"So you do know her?"
"Well, yes, of course. Many of us do."
Young turned aside to greet some more people. When those people had gone, Marshall was still standing there. Marshall pressed.
"So, what about these private sessions? Does she really have a clientele, including community leaders, elected officials, regents at the college?"
Young looked directly at Marshall, and his eyes were a little cold.
"Marshall, just what is your specific concern here?"
"Just doing my job. Whatever this is, it seems to be something the people of Ashton should know about, especially because it involves so many of the influential people who are shaping this town."
"Well, if you are concerned about it, I'm not the person to talk to. You should go and ask Professor Langstrat herself."
"Oh, I intend to. I just wanted to give you the chance to give me some honest answers, something I feel you're not quite doing."
Young's voice got a bit strained.
"Marshall, if I seem to be elusive, it is because what you are trying to pry into is protected by professional ethics. It is privileged information. I was simply hoping you would figure that out without my having to tell you."
Kate was calling from the sidewalk.
"Marshall, we're all waiting for you."
Marshall stepped away from the conversation, and it was just as well. It could only have gotten hotter from that point, and it was getting him nowhere anyway. Young was cool, very tough, and very slippery. A few states away, in a deep, secluded, and steep-sided valley rimmed by high mountains and carpeted with thick green ground cover and moss-tufted rock, a small but well-constructed cluster of buildings nestled like a lonely outpost in the center of the valley floor, accessible only by one rough and meandering gravel road. That little cluster of buildings, once a dismal and dilapidated old ranch, had been expanded into a complex of stone and brick buildings which now housed a small dormitory, an office complex, a dining hall, a maintenance building, a clinic, and several private dwellings. There were no signs, however, no labels anywhere, nothing to indicate where or what anything was. Drawing a charcoal streak across the sky, a sinister black object flew over the mountaintops and began to drop into the valley, piercing through the paper-thin layers of mist that hung in the air. Cloaked by oppressive spiritual darkness and silent as a black cloud, Baal-Raphar, the Prince of Babylon, floated along. He stayed close to the contour of the mountainside, maneuvering on a course that weaved this way and that among the dead snags and rocky crags. The canopy of darkness followed him like a cast shadow, like a tiny circle of night upon the landscape. A faint streak of red and yellow vapor trailed from his nostrils and hung in the air behind him like a long, slowly settling ribbon. Below, the ranch looked like a huge hive of hideous black insects. Several layers of ruthless warriors hovered almost stationary in a vast dome of defense over the complex, swords drawn, yellow eyes peering across the valley. Deep within this shell, demons of all shapes, sizes, and strengths darted about in a boiling mass of activity. As Rhaefar dropped closer, he noted a concentration of black spirits around a large, multi-storied stone house on the fringe of the cluster. "The strong man is there," he thought. So he banked gently to one side, changing his course for that building. The outer sentinel saw him approaching and gave an eerie, siren-like wail. Immediately, the defenders radiated outward from Rhaefar's flight path, opening a channel through the defense layers. Rhaefar swooped skillfully through the channel as demons on all sides saluted him with upheld swords, their glowing eyes like thousands of painted yellow stars on black velvet. He ignored them and passed quickly through. The channel closed again behind him like a living gate. He floated slowly down through the roof of the house, through the attic, past rafters, wall, plaster, through an upstairs bedroom, through a thick beam-supported floor, and down into a spacious living room below. The evil in the room was thick and confining, the darkness like black liquid that swirled about with any motion of the limbs. The room was crowded.
"Bel Rhaefar, the Prince of Babylon," a demon announced from somewhere,
and monstrous demons all around the perimeter of the room bowed in respect. Rhaefar folded his wings in regal cape-like fashion and stood with an intimidating air of royalty and might, his jewels flashing impressively. His big yellow eyes studied carefully the orderly ranks of demons lined up all around him. A horrible gathering. These were spirits from the principality levels, princes themselves of their own nations, peoples, tribes. Some were from Africa, some were from the Orient, several were from Europe. All were invincible. Rhaefar noted their tremendous size and formidable appearance. They all matched him for size and ferocity, and he doubted he would ever venture to challenge any of them. To receive a bow from them was a great honor, a compliment indeed.
"Hail, Rhaefar," said a gargling voice from the end of the room.
The strong man. It was forbidden to speak his name. He was one of the few majesties intimate with Lucifer himself, a vicious global tyrant responsible over the centuries for resisting the plans of the living God and establishing Lucifer's kingdom on the earth. Rhaefar and his kind controlled nations. Those such as the strong man controlled Rhaefar and his kind. The strong man rose from his place, and his huge form filled that part of the room. The evil that emanated from him could be felt everywhere, almost like an extension of his body. He was grotesque, hulking, his black hide hanging like sacks and curtains from his limbs and torso, his face a macabre landscape of bony prominences and deep-folded furrows. His jewels flashed brilliantly from his neck, chest, arms. His big black wings draped his body like a royal robe and trailed along the floor. Rhaefar bowed low in homage, feeling the strong man's presence from clear across the room.
"Hail, my lord!"
The strong man never wasted words.
"Shall we be detained again? The errors of Prince Lucius are being corrected. The new resistance is failing, my lord. Soon the town will be ready."
"And what of the host of heaven?"
"Limited."
The strong man did not like Rhaefar's answer. Rhaefar could feel that distinctly. He spoke slowly.
"We have received reports of a strong captain of the host being sent to Ashton. I believe you know him. I have reason to believe Tal has been sent, but I have anticipated him."
The big velvet-draped eyes burned with fury.
"Is it not this Tal who vanquished you at the fall of Babylon?"
Rhaefar knew he must answer, and quickly,
"It is this tower."
"Then the delays have cost us our advantage. You have now been matched strength for strength. My lord, you will see what your servant can do. Bold words, Rhaefar, but your strengths can only succeed with immediacy. The strengths of our enemies grow with time. All will be ready. And what of the man of God and the newspaper man? Does my lord even give them his attention? Your lord wishes you to give them yours. They are powerless, my lord, and will soon be removed."
"But only if Tal is removed,"
the strong man said derisively.
"Let me see it happen before you bother me in boasting about it. Until then, we remain confined here. Rhaefar, I will not wait long."
"Nor shall you need to."
The strong man only smirked.
"You have your orders. Begone!"
Rhaefar bowed low, and with an unfurling of his wings he quietly rose through the house until he was outside. Then, with a furious burst of rage, he swooped upward, sending unexpected demons tumbling out of the way. He picked up speed, his wings rushing in a blinding blur, and the defenders could barely get a channel open before he burst through it, trailing a hot stream of sulphurous breath. They closed up the channel again, giving each other curious looks as they watched him soar away. Rhaefar roared like a rocket up the side of the mountains and then out over the craggy peaks and back toward the little town of Ashton. In his rage, he cared not who saw him. He cared not about stealth or even decorum. Let the whole world see him and let it tremble. He was Rhaefar, the Prince of Babylon. Let all the world bow before him or be decimated under the edge of his sword. Tal. The very name was bitterness itself on his tongue. The lords of Lucifer would never let him forget that defeat so long ago. Never, until the day when Rhaefar redeemed his honor. And indeed he would. Rhaefar could see his sword gutting Tal and scattering him in shreds and pieces across the sky. He could feel the impact in his arms. He could hear the ripping sound of it. It was only a matter of time. Among the jagged rocks on one mountain summit, a silver-haired man came out of hiding to watch Rhaefar quickly shrink into the distance, etching a long black trail across the sky until he vanished over the horizon. The man took one more look at the demon-swarmed cluster of buildings in the valley, looked again toward the horizon, then vanished down the other side of the mountain in a flash of light and a flurry of wings.
Chapter 14. Well, thought Marshall, sooner or later I have to get around to it. On Thursday afternoon, when things were quiet, he closed himself in his office and made some phone calls, trying to track down Professor Julian Langstrand. He called the college, got the number of the psychology department, and went through two receptionists in two different offices before he finally found out that Langstrand was not in today and had an unlisted home number. Then Marshall thought of the very cooperative Albert Darr and gave his office a ring. Professor Darr was teaching, but would return his call if he would leave a message. Marshall left a message. 2 hours later, Albert Darr returned Marshall's call, and he did have the unlisted number for Julian Langstrat's apartment. Marshall called the number. It was busy. The living room of Julian Langstrat's apartment was dimly lit by one small lamp on the mantel. The room was quiet, warm, and comfortable. The shades were drawn to block out distractions, bright light, and any other disturbances. The phone was off the hook. Julian Langstrat sat in her chair, speaking quietly to her counselee who sat opposite her.
"You hear only the sound of my voice," she said, then repeated the sentence several times, quietly and clearly. "You hear only the sound of my voice." This went on for several minutes until her subject was in a deep hypnotic trance. "You are descending, descending deep within yourself."
Langstrat watched the face of her subject carefully.
She then extended her hands, palms out, fingers spread, and began to move her hands up and down just inches away from the subject's body, as if feeling for something. "Release your true self. Let it go. It is infinite, at unity with all existence. Yes, I can feel it. Can you read my energy returning to you?" The subject murmured, "Yes." "You are free from your body now. Your body is an illusion. You feel the bounds of your body dissolving away." Langstrath leaned in close, still using her hands. "You are free now." "Yes. Yes, I am free. I can feel your life force expanding. Yes, I can feel it. That's enough. You may stop there."
Langstrath was intent, closely observing everything.
"Go back. Go back. Yes, I can feel you receding. In a moment you will feel me slipping from you. Don't be alarmed. I'm still here."
In the next several minutes, she brought her subject slowly back out of the trance, step by step, suggestion by suggestion. Finally, she said,
"All right, when I count to three, you will awake. One, two, three."
Sandy Hogan opened her eyes, rolled them about dizzily, then took a deep breath, coming fully around.
"Wow,"
she responded. The three of them laughed together.
"Wasn't that something?"
asked Sean, sitting next to Langstrath.
"Wow,"
was all Sandy could say. This was a real first for Sandy. It had been Sean's idea, and though she hesitated at first, now she was very glad that she had gone along with it. The apartment shades were opened, and Sandy and Sean prepared to go back to their afternoon classes.
"Well, thank you for coming," said the professor at the door.
"Thank you," Sandy piped.
"And thank you for bringing her,"
Langstrath told Sean. Then she said to the two of them,
"Now remember, I wouldn't advise speaking to anyone about this. It's a very personal and intimate experience that we should all respect."
"Yeah, right, right," said Sandy. Sean drove her back to campus. It was Friday again, and Hank sat at home in his little corner office looking anxiously at the clock. Mary was usually very reliable. She had said that she would be back before Carmen got there for her afternoon counseling appointment. Hank had no idea if there were any spies watching the house, but he could never be sure. All he needed was for someone to figure out that Carmen was dropping in to see him while Mary went grocery shopping. Hank's fearful side could envision all kinds of plots his enemies might be forming against him, such as sending some strange and seductive woman to compromise and ruin him. Well, he knew one thing. If Carmen didn't show a genuine responsiveness to the counseling and begin to apply real solutions to a real problem, that would be the end of it as far as he was concerned. Uh-oh, there was the doorbell. He sneaked a look out the window. Carmen's red Fiat was parked out front. Yes, she was standing at the door in broad daylight in full view of 10 or 15 houses. The way she was dressed today made Hank figure he'd better let her in quickly, if only to get her out of sight. Where, oh, where was Mary? Mary was not sure she liked the new owners of what used to be Joe's Market. Oh, it wasn't their service or the way they ran the store or whether or not they were friendly. They were okay in most of those departments, and Mary also figured it would take time for them to know everyone, and vice versa. What bothered Mary was how obviously secretive they became any time she asked them whatever became of Joe Carlucci and his family. As far as Mary could find out, Joe, Angelina, and their children left Ashton abruptly and didn't tell anyone, and so far no one could be found who even knew where they went. Oh, well, she hurried out of the store and toward her car, a young box boy pushing a cart of groceries along behind her. She opened the trunk and watched the boy load the groceries in. And then she felt it. Suddenly, without any apparent reason, an unexplainable tinge of emotion, an odd mixture of fear and depression.
She felt cold, nervous, a little shaky, and could think of nothing but getting out of that place and hurrying home. Triskel had been accompanying her, guarding her, and he felt it too. With a metallic ring and a flash of light, his sword was instantly in his hand. Too late. From somewhere behind him came a stunning blow on the back of his neck. He toppled forward. His wings shot out to steady him, but an incredible weight came down on his back like a pile driver and pinned him down. He could see their feet like the clawed feet of hideous reptiles, and the red flicker of their blades. He could hear their sulphurous hissing. He looked up. At least a dozen demonic warriors surrounded him. They were towering, fierce, with glowing yellow eyes and dripping fangs, and they were sneering and gargling with laughter. Triskel looked to see if Mary was all right. He knew her safety would soon be threatened if he didn't act. But what could he do? What was that? He suddenly felt an intense wave of evil rolling over him.
"Pick him up," said a voice like thunder.
A vice-like hand curled around his neck and jerked him up as if he were a toy. Now he was looking at all these spirits eye to eye. They were newcomers to Ashton. He had never seen such size, strength, and brazenness. Their bodies were covered with thick iron-like scales. Their arms rippled with power. Their faces were mocking. Their sulphurous breath choked him. They turned him around and held him tightly, and he found himself face to face with a vision of sheer horror. Flanked by no less than 10 more huge demonic warriors, a gargantuan spirit stood with an S-curved sword in his monstrous black hand. Rhaefar. The thought coursed through Triskel's mind like a death sentence. Every inch of his being tightened with the anticipation of blows, defeat, unbearable pain. The big fanged mouth broke into a mocking and hideous grin. Amber saliva dripped from the fangs, and sulfur chugged forth in rancid clouds as the giant warlord chuckled mockingly.
"Are you so surprised?" Rhaefar asked. "You should feel privileged. You, little angel, are the first to look upon me."
"And how are you today?" Hank asked as he showed Carmen to a comfortable chair in his office area. She sank into the chair with a coo and a sigh, and Hank began to wonder where he left his tape recorder. He knew he was innocent of wrongdoing here, but some proof would be nice.
"I'm much better," she answered, and her voice was pleasant and even. "You know, maybe you can tell me why, but I haven't heard any voices talking to me all week."
"Oh, yeah," said Hank, finally getting his counselor's thoughts in gear. "That was what we were talking about, wasn't it?" Triskel looked toward Mary. She was thanking the box boy and closing her trunk. Rhaefar watched Triskel, amused.
"Oh, I see. You are here to protect her. From what? Did you expect to swat mere flies?"
Triskel had no answer. Rhaefar's tone became cruel and cutting.
"No, you are mistaken, little angel. It is a much greater power with whom you have to do."
Rhaefar tapped the ground with his sword, and Triskel immediately felt the iron hands of two demons clamping his arms from behind. He looked toward Mary. She was looking for the key to the car door. She was getting into the car. Another demon stretched out his sword and pierced the hood of the car. Mary tried to start the engine. Nothing happened. Rhaefar looked toward the nearby laundromat that faced the parking lot. A young, greasy-looking character stood in front of it, leaning against a post. Triskel could tell the man was possessed by one of Rhaefar's henchmen, as a matter of fact, several of them. At Rhaefar's nod, the demons went into action, and the man started walking toward Mary's car. Mary checked her lights. No, she had not left them on. She turned the key on and turned on the radio. It played. The horn honked. What on earth was the matter? She saw the young character coming her way from the direction of the laundromat. Oh, great. As Triskel watched helplessly, the demons guided the man up to the car window.
"Hey, cutie," he said. "Having some trouble here?"
Mary looked out at him. He was skinny, dirty, and dressed in black leather and chrome chains. She called through the windows. No, thanks. I'm all right.
He only smirked, eyeing her up and down as he asked,
Why don't you open up and let me see what I can do?
Hank didn't feel right about any of this. Where was Mary? At least Carmen was making a little more sense this time. She seemed to be dealing with her problems intelligently and with a genuine desire to change things. Maybe it would be different this time, but Hank wasn't counting on it.
So, he asked, what do you suppose became of those amorous voices in the night?
I don't listen to them anymore, she answered. There's one thing you helped me to realize just by talking about it. Those voices aren't real. I've only been fooling myself.
Hank was very gentle when he agreed.
Yes, I think you're right.
She heaved a deep sigh and looked at him with those big blue eyes.
I was trying to cope with my loneliness, that's all. I think that was it. Pastor, you're just so strong. I wish I could be that way.
Well, the Bible says I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me.
Uh-huh. Where's your wife?
Getting groceries. She should be back any minute.
Well,
Carmen leaned forward and smiled ever so sweetly.
I'm really drawing strength from your company. I want you to know that.
Mary could feel her heart pounding. What would this guy do next? The man leaned against the window, and his breath fogged the glass as he said,
Say, sweetheart, why don't you tell me your name?
Rafar grabbed Triskall by the hair and jerked his head around. Triskall thought his head would snap off. Rafar breathed sulfur right into Triskall's face as he said,
And now, little angel, I will have words with you.
The tip of the long sword came up to Triskall's throat.
Where is your captain?
Triskall did not answer. Rafar yanked his head around and let him look toward Mary. The man tried the latch on Mary's door. She was terrified. She groped for every lock button in the car, pushing each one down only seconds before the man could grab the outside latch. He tried all the doors, a leering smile on his face. Mary tried the horn again. A demon had already taken care of that. It didn't work. Rafar twisted Triskall's head back again, and the cold blade pressed against Triskall's face.
I will ask you again, where is your captain?
Carmen was still telling Hank how much good this counseling was doing her, how he reminded her of her former husband, and how she was looking for a man with his qualities. Hank had to put a lid on this stuff.
Well, he finally cut in. Do you have any other people in your life that you feel are significant as far as strength, support, friendship, those kinds of things?
She looked at him just a little mournfully.
Sort of. I have friends who hang out at the tavern, but nothing ever lasts.
She let her thoughts brew for a moment, then asked,
Do you think I'm attractive?
The man in black leather leaned close to Mary's window, threatened her with horrible obscenities, then started banging on the glass with a large metal buckle. Rafar nodded to a warrior whose hand passed through Mary's window and grasped the lock button, ready to pull it up at Rafar's order. The demons in the young man were drooling and ready. His hand was on the latch. Rafar made sure Triskall could see it all and then asked,
Your answer?
Triskall finally spoke, moaning,
The break.
Rafar held him tighter, leaning closer.
I didn't hear you.
Triskall repeated it.
The break.
Mary had a flash. The car was parked on an incline. It wasn't much, but it might be enough to get the car moving. She released the parking brake and the car started to roll. The creep wasn't expecting that. He banged on the window, tried to get around in front of the car to stop it, but it began to roll at a steady clip, and he soon realized that his efforts to stop it were becoming a little too obvious to other shoppers. A husky contractor standing by his big four-wheeler finally saw what was going on and hollered,
Hey, creep! What are you doing?
Rafar watched it happen, his rising anger coursing through his big iron fist, making it tighten more and more around Triskall. Triskall thought his neck would crack at any moment. but then Rhaefar seemed to give in.
"Desist,"
he ordered the demons. They backed off. The man gave up the chase and tried to saunter nonchalantly away. The big contractor started after him, and he fled. The car kept rolling. There was an exit from the parking lot that emptied onto a back street with a fairly good grade. Mary steered for it, hoping no other cars or pedestrians would get in her way. Triskall saw that she would make it. So did Rhaefar. The cold steel of his blade pressed against Triskall's throat.
"Well done, little angel. You have spared your charge until a more opportune time. I will leave you with only a message for today. Pay careful attention."
With that, Rhaefar released Triskall into the hands of his henchmen. One huge, warty demon pounded his iron fist into Triskall's torso and sent him spinning into the air, where another demon intercepted him with a swat of his sword, carving a deep gash in his back. Triskall fluttered and tumbled down in a daze, into the clutches of two more demons who pummeled his limp body with iron fists and tore at him with taloned feet. For several horrible minutes the demons made violent sport with him as Rhaefar coldly watched. Finally the great Baal gave a growled command, and the warriors let Triskall go. He flopped to the ground, and Rhaefar's big taloned foot stomped down on his neck. The huge sword swung down and waved in small circles before Triskall's eyes as the demon master spoke.
"You will tell your captain that Rhaefar, the Prince of Babylon, is looking for him."
The big foot pressed harder.
"You will tell him."
Suddenly Triskall was alone, a limp, ragged wreck. He struggled to his feet again. All he could think of now was Mary. Hank gently took hold of Carmen's hand, lifted it off his own, and placed it courteously in her lap. He held it there for just a moment and looked into her eyes with compassion and yet firmness. He let go of it and then leaned back in his chair to a safe distance. "Carmen," he said with a soft and understanding voice, "I'm very flattered that you're so impressed with my masculine qualities. And really, I have no doubts that a woman of your particular qualities will have no trouble finding a good man with whom to build a lasting and meaningful relationship. But listen, I don't mean to sound abrupt, but I have to emphasize one thing right here and now. I am not that man. I'm here as a minister and counselor, and we have to keep this relationship strictly limited to that of a counselor and his client." Carmen seemed very disturbed and very offended.
"What are you saying to me?"
"I'm saying that we really can't continue these appointments. They're causing emotional conflicts for you. I think you'll be better off going to someone else." Hank couldn't explain why, but even as he said that, he felt like he had just won some kind of battle. From the icy look in Carmen's eyes, he figured she had lost. Mary was crying, wiping the tears from her face with her sleeve and praying a mile a minute.
"Father God, dear Jesus, save me, save me."
The hill was beginning to flatten out. The car slowed down 15, 10, 5 miles an hour. She looked behind and saw no one following, but she was too scared by now to be comforted. She just wanted to get home. Then up the street behind her and about 10 feet above the ground, Triskall flew, his clothes flashing with white-hot light and his wings rushing. His flight path was wobbly and the rhythm of his wings out of sync, but he was determined nevertheless. His face was etched with deep concern for her welfare. He spread his tattered, fluttering wings like a large canopy and let them break him to a stop as he settled down onto the roof of the car. By now it was barely rolling, and Mary just kept crying and wailing, jerking her body in futile attempts to urge the car onward. Triskall reached down through the roof and gently placed his hand on Mary's shoulder.
"Shh. Be calm. It's all right now. You're safe."
She looked behind her again and began to quiet down a little. Triskall spoke to her heart.
"The Lord has saved you. He won't let you go.
You're all right. The car was almost to a complete stop now. Mary pulled it over to the side of the street and parked it while she still had the momentum to do so. She pulled on the parking brake and sat there for several minutes just to compose herself. "That's it," said Triscoll, comforting her in her spirit. "Rest in the Lord. He's here." Triscoll slid off the roof of the car and reached his arm down through the hood, probing around. He found whatever it was he was looking for. "Mary," he said, "why don't you try again?" Mary sat in the car thinking to herself that the stupid thing would never start and what horrible timing it had to die and leave her in such a fix. "Come on," Triscoll prodded. "Take a step of faith. Trust God. You never know what he might do." Mary decided to take one more stab at starting the car, even though she had little faith that anything would happen. She twisted the key. The engine cranked over, then sputtered, then started. She gave it several powerful revs just to make sure it stayed awake. Then, still in a very great hurry to get home to Hank's protecting arms, she pulled out into the street and hot-rodded for home with Triscoll riding on the roof. Hank was very relieved to hear the slam of the car door outside. "Oh, that must be Mary." Carmen got up. "I guess I'd better go." Now that Mary was here, Hank added, "Oh, listen, you don't have to. You can stay for a while."
"No, no, I'll just leave. Maybe I ought to go out the back, even."
"No, don't be silly. Here, I'll see you to the door. I need to help Mary with those groceries anyway." But Mary had forgotten about the groceries and only wanted to get inside the house. Triscoll ran beside her. He was battered and limping, his clothing was torn, and he could still feel the fiery wound in his back. Hank opened the door. "Hi, hon. Boy, I was getting worried about you." Then he saw her tear-filled eyes. "Hey, what?" Carmen screamed. It was a sudden, heart-piercing scream that halted every thought and stifled any words. Hank spun around, not knowing what to expect.
"No!"
Carmen shrieked, her arms guarding her face.
"Are you mad? Get away from me, you hear? Get away!"
As Hank and Mary both looked on in horror, Carmen backed into the room, waving her arms as if trying to shield herself from some invisible attacker. She stumbled around the room. She tumbled over the furniture. She cursed and spewed horrible obscenities. She was terrified and enraged at the same time, her eyes wide and glassy, her face contorted. Creone tried to grab Triscoll and hold him back. Triscoll had glorified and was a shimmering white. His tattered wings filled the room and glimmered like a thousand rainbows. He held a gleaming sword in his hand, and the sword flashed and sang in blinding arcs as he engaged in a frenzied battle with Lust, a hideous demon with a black-scaled, slippery body like a lizard and a red tongue that lashed about his face like the tail of a snake. Lust was first defending himself, then lashing back with his glowing red sword, the crescent blade cutting crimson arcs through the air. The swords clashed with explosions of fire and light.
"Let me be, I tell you!"
Lust screamed, his wings propelling him like a trapped hornet about the room. "Let him be!" shouted Creone, trying to hold Triscoll back while staying out of the path of that infinitely sharp blade. "Do you hear my order? Let him be!" At last Triscoll withdrew, but held his sword steady and kept it raised in front of him, the light from the blade illuminating his raging face, his burning eyes. Carmen calmed down, rubbed her eyes, and looked about the room with a frightened expression. Hank and Mary went to her immediately and tried to comfort her.
"What's wrong, Carmen?"
Mary asked, wide-eyed and concerned.
"It's just me, Mary. Did I do something? I didn't mean to scare you."
"No, no,"
moaned Carmen.
"It wasn't you. It was somebody else."
"Who? What?" Lust backed off, his sword still held high. Creone told him, "We will give place to you no longer today. Begone, and don't come here again." Lust folded his wings and circled carefully around the two heavenly warriors and over to the door.
"I was leaving anyway," the demon hissed.
"I was leaving anyway," said Carmen, composing herself. There's bad energy in this place. Goodbye.
She bolted out the door. Mary tried to call after her, but Hank touched Mary's arm and let her know that silence would be best for now. Creoni held Triskall until the light around him faded and he replaced his sword. Triskall was shaking.
Triskall, Creoni scolded. You know Tal's orders. I was with Hank the whole time. He did just fine. There was no need.
Then Creoni saw Triskall's many injuries and the deep wound in his back.
Triskall, what happened? I could not let myself be assailed by still another,
Triskall gasped.
Creoni, we are more than matched.
Mary finally remembered that she was about to cry. She picked up where she had left off.
Mary, what in the world is going on here? Hank asked, putting his arms around her.
Just close the door, honey, she cried. Just close the door and hold me. Please.
Chapter 15 Kate grabbed a kitchen towel and hurriedly wiped her hands so she could pick up the phone.
Hello?
Hi there. It was Marshall. Kate knew what was coming. It had been happening a lot the last 2 weeks.
Marshall, I am cooking dinner, and I am cooking enough for all four of us.
Yeah, well... Marshall had the tone of voice he always used when he was about to weasel out of something.
Marshall?
Then Kate turned her back toward the living room where Sandy and Sean were studying and talking. But mostly talking. She didn't want them to see the distress in her face. She lowered her voice.
I want you to come home for dinner. You've been out late all this week. You've been so busy and so preoccupied, I hardly have a husband anymore.
Kate, Marshall broke in, it won't be as bad as you thought. I'm just calling to say I'll be a little late, not that I won't be there.
How late?
Oh, brother. Marshall wasn't sure at all. How about an hour?
Kate couldn't think of what to say. She only sighed in disgust and anger. Marshall tried to appease her.
Listen, I'll get there as soon as I can.
Kate decided to say it over the phone. She might never get the chance any other time.
Marshall, I'm concerned about Sandy.
What's wrong with her now?
Oh, she could just punch him for that tone of voice.
Marshall, if you'd just be around here once in a while, you'd know. She's... I don't know. She just isn't the same old Sandy anymore. I'm afraid of what Sean is doing to her.
What Sean is doing to her?
I can't talk about it over the phone.
Now Marshall sighed.
All right, all right. We'll talk about it.
When, Marshall?
Oh, tonight, when I get home.
We can't talk right in front of them.
I mean, oh, you know what I mean.
Marshall was tiring of this conversation.
Well, just get home, Marshall, please.
All right, all right.
Marshall hung up the phone with hardly a loving gentleness. For a split second, he regretted the act and thought about how it must have made Kate feel. But he forced his thoughts onward to the next very pressing project, interviewing Professor Julian Langstrat. Friday evening. She should be home now. He dialed the number, and this time it rang. And rang. And rang one more time. Click.
Hello?
Hello, this is Marshall Hogan, editor of the Ashton Clarion. Am I speaking with Professor Julian Langstrat?
Yes, you are. What can I do for you, Mr. Hogan?
My daughter Sandy has been in some of your classes.
She seemed pleased to hear that.
Oh, very good.
At any rate, I was wondering if we might set up a date for an interview.
Well, you'd have to speak with one of my teacher assistants. They're the ones responsible for checking the progress and problems of the students. The classes are large, you understand.
Oh, well, no, that's not exactly what I had in mind. I was thinking I'd like to interview you.
Pertaining to your daughter? I'm afraid I don't know her. I wouldn't be able to tell you much.
Well, we could talk a little about the class, of course, but I was also curious about the other interests you're pursuing there on the campus. The elective classes you've been teaching at night.
Oh, she said with a down note at the end that didn't sound promising. Well, that was part of an experimental college idea we were trying. If you wish to check that out, the registrar might have some old flyers available. But I should inform you that I am very uncomfortable with the idea of granting any interview to the press, and I really cannot do so.
So you're not willing to discuss the very influential people you have among your circle of friends?
I don't understand the question. And it sounded like she didn't appreciate it either.
Alf Brummel, Chief of Police, Reverend Oliver Young, Dolores Pinkston, Dwight Brandon, Eugene Baylor, Judge John Baker.
I have no comment, she said sharply, and I really have some other things that are very pressing. Is there anything else I can help you with?
Well, Marshall thought he'd go ahead and try for it. I guess the only other thing I could ask you about is why you ejected me from your class.
Now she was getting indignant. I don't know what you're talking about.
Your class on Monday afternoon, 2 weeks ago. The psychology of self, I think it was. I'm the big guy you told to leave.
She began to laugh incredulously.
I haven't the slightest idea what you're talking about. You must have the wrong person.
You don't remember telling me to wait outside?
I am convinced you have me mixed up with someone else.
Well, do you have long blonde hair?
She said simply, good night, Mr. Hogan, and hung up. Marshall stood there a moment, then asked himself,
come on, Hogan, what did you expect?
He dropped the receiver into the cradle and went out into the front office, where a question from Bernice grabbed his attention.
So, I'd like to know how you're finally going to corner Langstrat, she quipped, flipping through some papers at her desk.
Marshall felt like his face must be awfully red.
Boy, your face is sure red, Bernice confirmed.
Talking to too many temperamental women in one night, he explained. Langstrat was one of them. Boy, I thought Harmel was bad.
Bernice turned around, excited.
You got Langstrat on the phone?
For all of 32 seconds. She had absolutely nothing to say to me, and she didn't remember kicking me out of her class.
Bernice made a screwy face.
Isn't it funny how no one seems to remember having any encounters with us? Marshall, we must be invisible.
How about very undesirable and very inconvenient?
Well, Bernice said, going back to her paperwork, Professor Langstrat probably has been very busy, too busy to talk to nosy reporters.
A wad of paper bounced off her head. She turned around and saw Marshall looking over some lists. He looked like he couldn't possibly have tossed that little projectile. He said,
boy, I wonder if I could contact Harmel again. But he won't talk either.
The same wad of paper bounced off his ear. He looked at Bernice, and she was dead serious, all business.
Well, it's obvious he knew too much. It's my guess that both he and former Dean Strawn are running good and scared.
Yeah.
Marshall had a memory come to the surface.
Harmel talked that way, warning me. He said something like, I'd be out on my ear like everybody else.
So, who's everybody else?
Yeah. Who else do we know who could have been removed?
Bernice looked over some of her notes.
Well, you know, now that I look over this list, none of these people have really been in their position for a very long time.
The wad of paper ricocheted off her head and skittered across her desk.
So who did they replace? Marshall asked.
Bernice solemnly picked up the wad of paper as she said,
we can check that out. In the meantime, the most obvious thing to do is to call Strawn and see what...
She hurled the wad at Marshall.
He has to say.
Marshall grabbed the wad in mid-flight and quickly crumpled another one to add to his arsenal, sending them both back in Bernice's direction. Bernice began to prepare an adequate counterattack.
All right, Marshall said, starting to crack up with laughter. I'll give him a ring.
He was suddenly in the middle of a blizzard of paper wads.
But I think we'd better get out of here. My wife's waiting.
Bernice was not finished with the war yet, so they finished it and then had to clean up before they could leave. Rafar paced up and down the dark basement room, chugging out hot breath that became a layer of cloud obscuring him from the shoulders up. He pounded his fists together. He tore invisible enemies in his outstretched talons. He cursed and fumed. Lucius stood with the other warriors waiting for Rafar